Call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect, it is 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday, April 3rd, 2019. Present are Vice Chair Coghill, Senator Giesel, Senator Keel, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Bishop is excused, and Senator Reinbold is excused, and I'm here myself, Chairman Birch. Please silence your cell phones. I would note that we have one item on today's agenda, and that is SB 87, to limit non-resident taking of game by Senator Coghill. This is the first hearing on Senate Bill 87. It's my intent to have the bill sponsor introduce the bill and then take invited testimony from several big game hunting groups that represent both sides of this issue. With that, we'll have the bill sponsor, Vice Chairman Coghill, explain the bill. Vice Chairman, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Senator Coghill from Senate Seat B in the Fairbanks area. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill number 87. It's in our fish and game rules, which are Title 16, and this falls under Article 2, Boards of Fish and Game, and it gets down to the game management, regulation of Board of Game Management, and this section deals with the non-residents. Mr. Chairman, this is one of those issues where my friends don't all agree. But they are still my friends. And so I'm just going to bring this discussion up because I don't know the best answer for this, but here's the reason why I chose to introduce this. Being born and raised here, and most of us in my hometown just lived on the food abundance, whether it was in the river or whether it was out in the field. And so this asks the question, should the residents of Alaska get a preference when it comes to when it's necessary to restrict? That's what this issue is about. Before I get to this issue, though, under the game board regulations, they've already set a priority as well as in this section. And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to read that section of statute under 1605-255. It's subpart D. And it says regulations adopted under A of this section must provide that consistent with the provisions of 1605-258, which is subsistence hunting, basically. And taking a moose, deer, elk, caribou by residents for personal or family consumption has preference over taking by non-residents. So that's a principle that they've operated under. And for the most part, have done pretty good. Then when it comes to permits, then there's another question. And so if you look in this short little statute section, there's a couple of operatives that the big one is I've taken a may to a shall, which makes it from permissive to mandatory. And I think you're going to hear both sides of this on why the shall gives a preference to the residents of Alaska and why the may gives a flex point with the Board of Game. But it is, remember, it's when it's necessary to restrict the taking of big game and when the opportunity for state residents to take that big game can be reasonably satisfied. So those are kind of the principles that we're going at here is the necessary restriction, the opportunity for residents to be reasonably satisfied. Presently, the law says may through a permit system limit the taking of big game by non-residents. What this would say is no, it must. Then you must, through a permit system, limit the taking of big game by non-residents and non-resident aliens. So it's a hard requirement. Part of it comes from an argument within the Board of Game, and that is have we treated the resident hunters at the level they should be treated, or are we chasing dollars for non-residents? And that goes to the heart of the question, really. So I agreed that I fall on the side of let's make sure that the residents are taken care of. I think what you're going to hear today is both sides of this question, why some people feel like the Board of Game has been tone deaf, and partly why the dollars that bring these non-residents in has been not only valuable to Alaska, but has not been harmful to the residents of Alaska taking. It's going to be up to us, really, to hear those parts as clearly as we can. I've tried to be as even-handed as I can, but I said that I would put this on the table so that we as a legislature could hear what that discussion looks like without the vitriol, without phone calls, without emails. So I appreciate, under this very busy session, you being willing to take the time for us to bring forward the best argument we can. So I've asked some invited testimony to come today to lay out the issue before us, and then I would move from there into further discussions. But I didn't want to just have us listen to 50 or 60 people who had strong opinions but not solutions. And so my idea today is to bring the strong opinions that are thoughtful to the table, and then us ask the question, do we trust the Board of Game to continue on the way they are, or do we want to put this restriction in there? So, Mr. Chairman and committee members, that's the reason I've done this. It's with no malice towards anybody. It's just to ask, when it comes to non-residents on a permit system, should we always restrict them when the reasonable opportunity for residents comes under these restrictive conditions? So if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, that's the reason, and as simple as I can be. I did ask the Fish and Game people to be on the line today so that we could ask questions if they come up, but I've also asked people on both sides of the issue to bring their best foot forward.
Thank you, Vice Chairman Coghill. I would note that we do have Fish and Game and the Board of Game available to answer questions. Eddie Grasser, Director of Fish and Game Division of Wildlife Conservation, is online, as is Christy Tibbles, Executive Director for the Board of Game. Questions, committee members?
I do.
Senator Kawasaki?
And I don't know who would be most appropriate to answer the question, but there is a letter of support by the chairman of the Board of Game, and I don't know to whom I should direct the question to, but does the Board of Game support this this change?
I would say, Senator Kawasaki, we do have Christy Tibbles, Executive Director for the Board of Game, online. Tibbles, are you available to answer that question from Senator Kawasaki?
Good afternoon. Yes, I am, although I might ask him to repeat it. Does the Board of Game support the bill? Was it to oppose the bill?
Through the chair, there's a letter dated April 1st to Senator Coghill. It's on Board of Game letterhead, and it's signed by the chairman of the Alaska Board of Game. And it seems to be that they are supportive, not supportive of this particular piece of legislation. And did the board vote on it?
Thank you, through the chair. The Board of Game did bring this up at their recent board meeting. In mid-March, there was a request to do a letter, and there wasn't objection in the chair doing so, but there was not a motion or a vote by the board to do so.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll just note that in the first paragraph he expressed that, it says, to express my opinion. And so I think it's pretty clear, but it was a board discussion, so.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I guess one question I would have is whether or not the Board of Game is doing an adequate job of managing the allocation of big game, and I guess the intent of this proposal would be for the legislature to kind of insert themselves in. I'm kind of asking the sponsor, is that a fair statement?
That's one of the reasons why I introduced the bill, is because there are those that feel that the Board of Game has been tone deaf to some non-residents, and I think they need to have a reason to tell us why that is the case, and if this helps the Board of Game see a different perspective. Helps us, though, enter into what that discussion looks like. And I can tell you, it's been hard for me to get my head around as well. But I do err on the side of let's take care of the residents of Alaska first, and I want to hear why this made a shell would be helpful or not.
Fair enough. Okay. Well, we have now, we can go to invited testimony, and I'd like to keep testimony and committee questions for each testifier to about 14 minutes. I believe we have four. We have Mr. Richards, who is, I believe, here in the room. We have Gary Colbath with the Alaska Bow Hunters online. And then Sam Rohr and Thor Stacy in the room, and then Rod Arno with the Alaska Outdoor Council. So we'll start with Mark Richards, resident hunters of Alaska. If you could come forward, identify yourself for the record, and proceed. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Mark Richards. I'm the Executive Director of Resident Hunters of Alaska. We pronounce our acronym RAC, and I'm here before you today representing some 2,000 Alaskans from across the state who are members and who support Senate Bill 87. I'd first like to thank Senator Coghill for introducing this legislation. It allows us to begin a conversation on issues that have been going on with the border game for quite a while now that you may not be fully aware of. I want to begin by quoting a paragraph on page 7 of this ever-growing hunting regulation booklet that we fondly call the Handy Dandy. It states, and I quote, "Non-residents are allowed to hunt when there is enough game to allow everyone to participate. When there isn't enough game, non-resident hunters are restricted or eliminated first. If more restrictions are necessary, seasons and bag limits may be reduced or eliminated for some residents," unquote. The funny thing about that statement, though, it's nowhere in statute, and it's not how the Board of Game makes decisions. It's an unfulfilled promise by the state right there in writing in our own hunting regulation booklet. This legislation seeks to help to fulfill that promise. Senate Bill 87 is very narrow and seeks to ensure that when wildlife populations are diminished or there are conservation or other concerns that lead to restrictions or reductions in resident hunting opportunities, that non-resident hunters are limited in opportunity first. They bear the brunt of any restrictions. This bill does not in any way affect the board's overall authority on allocation decisions. The board will still be allowed to offer unlimited non-resident sheep hunting opportunity in areas of the interior, while at the same time acknowledging that non-resident guided hunters taking 60 to 80% of our sheep creates conflicts of field, overcrowding, and leads to less resident success rates. Moose draw permits where non-resident hunters receive 50% of the allocation will still be on the books. The board will still be allowed to allocate 40% of Kodiak brown bear tags to non-resident hunters. And the board will continue to be able to create new must-be-guided species absent legislative approval to benefit the guide industry. Those are all other issues of how and why RAC was formed nearly 3 years ago, but those aren't the issues we seek to address with this legislation. The existing statute, AS 1605-256, essentially tells the Board of Game that whenever they need to restrict resident big game hunting opportunities, they may then put non-resident hunters on a draw permit system to limit their opportunity. We have never seen the board take that action in the last dozen years. Instead, the decisions the board has made over the past dozen years either restrict everyone equally, or we end up with scenarios like this example. The Central Arctic caribou herd is an identified intensive management prey population whose highest and best use is to provide food for Alaskans. This is the last remaining general season caribou hunt along the road system, off the Hall Road in Unit 26B. I've hunted it many times, and many of our members have a long history of hunting the Central Arctic herd to fill their freezers. In 2016, the herd dramatically declined from about 50,000 animals to about 22,000 animals, falling below the intensive management population objective. And the Department of Fish and Game asked for reduced seasons and bag limits for all hunters. The board ended up severely reducing seasons and bag limits for both residents and non-residents without having non-resident hunters bear the full brunt of those restrictions first in lost opportunity. And now non-resident caribou hunters take the majority of the harvest in Unit 26B of the declining Central Arctic caribou herd. The Board of Game chairman would tell you that this was a mistake. They didn't intend for this end result, and they will fix it at the next meeting and cycle for this region. The legislature should not get involved. Let them fix it. But here's the facts. The board made their final decision with eyes wide open, based on a Department of Fish and Game projection that this would lead to 43% of the Central Arctic herd harvest going to non-resident hunters. The department was off on the low side by 12 points, as it led to non-resident hunters now taking 55% of the harvest. But the Board of Game should never have allowed for a 43% non-resident harvest after taking away so much opportunity from residents. That is what this legislation seeks to address. That's why we need shall instead of may. One comment in opposition to this bill stated that until it could be shown how this change will put more meat in Alaskans' freezers and benefit Alaskans, he can't support it. Had the word shall instead of may been in statute, I can guarantee you that more meat from the Central Arctic herd would be in Alaskans' freezers today. This legislation is indeed a significant benefit to resident hunters. I want to stress that we fully understand that due to the complex nature of wildlife management and often contentious wildlife allocation decisions, the legislature has granted broad authority to the Alaska Board of Game to determine all wildlife allocation decisions. This system works well for the most part, but like any institutional system over time, it needs to have the hood opened and inspected and to see if we need any fixes or updates. I was grateful that Senate Bill 87 was introduced the day before the recent Board of Game meeting in Anchorage a couple weeks ago. At the outset of that meeting, the AG attorney attached to the board brought up the bill as something the board should be made aware of and thus inform the public as well. Caught by surprise, the chairman went on a bit of a rant and ended up ostensibly speaking for the entire board by saying, quote, "This board does not like the word shall. May to shall ties our hands," unquote. I'd point out that there are other instances within our Title 16 statutes that include the provision shall, even the word must. Yes, shall is meant, if you want to look at it that way, to tie hands. It requires a certain outcome. That's the entire purpose of this bill, to require a certain outcome so we don't end up with situations like we have now with the Central Arctic caribou herd. In closing, some may oppose this bill because it affects non-resident hunting opportunity. Potentially, this could impact some guides, even for species which are not required to hire a guide. But again, this bill is very narrow and only applies in circumstances where resident hunting opportunity is restricted or reduced. It applies when the Board of Game has determined they can't allow wide open opportunity for everyone. Some non-residents and some guides could be negatively affected. Sure, that's true. This was just as true under the May provision currently in statute, which is why there is no fiscal note in this bill. That doesn't mean, however, that this change is not the right thing to do. Resident hunters must come first under circumstances when their opportunities have to be restricted. Perhaps some will make the argument that the legislature should not interfere in the Board of Game's business, that the decisions they make are more nuanced and complex than the legislature understands, that the board knows best. One thing I have learned in my time here in the Capitol over the last 2 years, though, is that you legislators are fully capable of taking in information and making sense of it on a wide variety of issues. This is no different. listen to the facts, ask questions, make an informed decision. That's all we're asking. We're opening the hood for you. We're showing you just a small slice of the problems we see, and we sincerely appreciate you hearing us out. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony this afternoon, Mr. Richards. We'll see if there's any questions. Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
You bet. See, next we have Gary Colbath with the Alaska Bowhunters Association. I believe, let's see. Yeah, Gary, are you online?
I am online. Can you hear me?
We certainly can. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. You have up to 15 minutes here for your presentation. Any questions? Thank you for joining us. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your remarks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chairman Birch and members of the committee. My name is Gary Colbath. I am a lawyer by trade, but I appear here in my capacity as the volunteer vice president for the Alaskan Bowhunters Association. I am here today representing our hundreds of Alaskan and non-resident bowhunters who hunt our great state. In fact, each year, thousands of bowhunters from within our organization and from without come here to Alaska to hunt. I have come here to voice our organization's support for Senate Bill 87. As I know you've already just heard the comments from Mr. Richards on behalf of the resident hunters of Alaska, I will try not to revisit the exact points he made. The Alaskan bowhunters support Senate Bill 87 as this legislation helps to ensure that when restriction on hunting rights, like bag limits or tag availability or season lengths, need to occur due to declining wildlife populations, conservation concerns, or other environmental factors, that non-resident hunters face restriction first and in an equal or greater amount than resident hunters do. Senate Bill 87 is simply an insurance policy for resident Alaskan hunters, your constituents, that will require non-resident hunters' rights be first affected by any restrictions or reductions in seasons and bag limits when, for whatever reason, the Board of Game decides to impose those. This legislation is very narrow, as I think was mentioned, and does not in any way affect the Board of Game's overall authority on allocation decisions. The Board of Game has always had the authority to limit non-resident hunters. This bill does not change that. They have the authority when resident hunters were restricted due to declining game populations and conservation concerns under the May provision, and nothing about this will limit that authority that they currently possess today. Instead, the board will simply now, if the bill is passed, have to consider and restrict the rights of non-resident hunters first as reductions or limitations become necessary. We understand this legislation could be opposed by the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, and we've heard that it's not supported by the chairman of the Board of Game. The Alaska Bowhunters Association does not see this bill as anti-non-resident or anti-guide. Indeed, our group has many guides and outfitters as members and non-resident hunters as members. The bill only comes into play in times when seasons and bag limits and hunters' rights need to be reduced for conservation or wildlife's benefit. When there are conservation concerns, wildlife populations are in decline, or maybe habitat is suffering from overcrowding concerns, in those times, this bill simply tells the board that they must regulate and restrict non-resident rights first, and at least as much as resident rights when trying to address any critical situation. I also want to touch on the example brought up by Mr. Richards, an example of the harm this bill seeks to address and one that directly affects the Alaskan bowhunters. Bowhunters and members of our group did occur along the archery corridor up on the Dalton Highway, which happens to be the largest bow hunting only area in the entire country. The Alaska, in 2016, the Alaska Department of Game and Fish determined, as was noted, that caribou herd was drastically reduced or had been in numbers from over 50,000 animals to 22,000 animals. The need was determined that seasons and bag limits should be reduced for both residents and non-residents. The Central Arctic herd is an identified intensive management prey population important for Alaskan human consumption. And the taking of caribou by residents for personal and family consumption has preference under our Constitution and under our laws for overtaking by non-residents. That hunt is the only remaining general season hunt along the road system in Unit 26B. After the board severely reduced seasons and bag limits for both residents and non-residents, even though the Game Fish and Parks projection that this would lead to the 43% reduction that was mentioned, in reality, the results show that non-resident hunters now take 55% of the harvest, taking away much opportunity for resident hunters. This example is precisely the type of situation that Senate Bill 87 is meant to prevent. It is a narrow, simple, and common sense piece of legislation. None of Alaska's resident hunters who would expect to travel to a state in the lower 48 to hunt, yet be regulated less and more favorably than the residents who live there and support the local land and game. We believe in turn that our non-resident members understand the value of Alaskans' animals to our residents and the need to support the land here in Alaska through sound conservation, such that they too would be supportive of the preference that this bill creates. The Alaskan Bowhunters Association hopes that sound management policies by the board and good conservation practices by the Department of Game and Fish never again require additional hunting restrictions for any of our members, any residents of Alaska, or any non-residents who come here to hunt. However, Senate Bill 87 just provides that if such restrictions ever become needed again, non-residents will simply be affected first. Their rights will be considered and reduced first, and at least as much as those of us who live here. Again, the bill simply creates a process that says when our game populations or the land that game live on are in crisis, non-residents will be the first to be limited, and resident rights will only be affected after consideration of non-resident changes. It's a good bill for bow hunters, as we see it, in all areas of Alaska. It's good for our state. It's good for conservation. It's good for the wildlife and the wildlands they inhabit. Therefore, we urge you to vote for it and support it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony this afternoon, Mr. Colbath. I'll see if there are any committee questions. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Colbath, thank you for your testimony. I haven't hunted the Hall Road, but I think if I'm looking in the reg book for this coming year, this is the 26B remainder that's got a portion within the Dalton Highway management area, controlled use area. As I look in the reg book, residents at two bulls, non-residents at one, residents August to April, non-residents August to September. So would the restrictions in place right now satisfy the language of the bill?
It would be my belief that if the, and just so I understand your question correctly, I guess first, you're saying if the bill passed and the regulations read shall, would the current restrictions satisfy that?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's the question. Thank you.
That's affirmative.
Yes, I believe that it would. I believe that it would be a situation where non-resident rights would be restricted or could be limited in some fashion, either equal to or more so than the rights of residents, certainly.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Colbath. Seeing no other questions, thank you very much for your presentation this afternoon. Next, we have Sam Royer and Thor Stacy with the Alaska Professional Hunters Association. I think we'll want to take a brief at ease here while we set up their PowerPoint presentation. All right, back on the record. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Birch and committee members. For the record, my name is Sam Rohr. I'm a master hunting guide and the president of Alaska Professional Hunters Association. Our testimony today is in opposition to Senate Bill 87. A little about myself. My wife and I and our four children make our home on Kodiak Island, where we were all born and raised, and we operate a small hunting camp on the west side of the island. It's an old historic camp that was pioneered by Charlie Mattson, one of the first bear hunting guides on Kodiak in the early 1900s. My father first started working at this camp in the late 70s, and he took it over in 1981. I grew up at the camp and started guiding hunters and fishermen as soon as I was old enough to obtain a license. My wife and I took over this business from my parents 3 years ago and are now raising our children in the business just as I was raised in it. My story isn't unusual around the state. Guide operations in Alaska are largely family affairs made up of many second and even third generation guides. These are small family and community-based businesses with over 80% serving fewer than 15 clients per year and 40% serving fewer than 6 clients per year. Big game guiding in Alaska has one of the highest rates of resident ownership of any other state industry at approximately 90% Alaskan owned. Many of these guides live in rural Alaska close to the resources they hunt. In fact, over 50% of the $52 million in new dollars that guiding brings to the state stays in rural Alaska. We provided the committee with two reports that highlight the guiding industry's contribution to the state, and I'm happy to answer any questions on those. But what I really wanted to do is walk you through what this looks like on a micro level in the local community for the individual business owner. I personally charge a client around $23,000 for a Kodiak bear hunt. So here's where the money goes. $2,500 goes to the local transporter who flies us to the field. $4,000 pays the wages of the local guides I employ. $2,000 pays a packer and cook, again, local Kodiak folks. $1,000 was spent for food in the local grocery store. $500 for fuel at the local fuel dock. And another $500 for miscellaneous supplies from the local sporting goods store. $2,000 for business expenses like workman's comp and liability insurance, again, bought from the local broker. $1,000 should be set aside for maintenance costs of camp and equipment and boats. So altogether, it costs around $13,500 to put on the hunt. That money was all spent with local businesses. At the end of the hunt, I made a profit of approximately $9,500. Now, I'll probably tithe 10% of that to my local church and local charities, and the rest gets spent on my house payment, groceries, property taxes to fund our local school district, fundraisers for the kids' sports teams, and school clothes. Hopefully at the end I'll have a little bit left over to put away for retirement, because I'm sure you're all aware I won't be able to pack bear hides forever. All of the $23,000 was spent locally. Certainly it benefited my family and I, but it also benefited my entire community as well. This is what happens in rural communities across our state each hunting season. It's small local businesses supporting other small local businesses. So why does this work? It's because Alaska is home to an incredibly vast wildlife resource. We have 8 species of big game animals that are unique to our state. that are all open to over-the-counter hunting opportunities. Doll sheep, coastal brown bear, mountain goats, grizzly bear, Alaska Yukon moose, barren ground caribou, Sitka black-tailed deer, and muskox. This world-class resource is what sets Alaska apart from the rest of the country. Of course, resident Alaskans have opportunities to hunt these incredible resources as well, but non-residents pay a much higher cost for this opportunity. While they only represent 13% of the hunters in the field, they pay for over 72% of Alaska's wildlife management. This non-resident contribution ensures that resident Alaskans can continue to hunt for a very low cost. Our vision for the future is that guide businesses continue to remain viable long into the future, adding value to Alaska's iconic wildlife resources and bringing opportunity and financial resources to rural Alaska. That non-resident hunters continue to pay the lion's share of Alaska's wildlife management, and that resident Alaskans can continue to raise their families with strong hunting traditions for as little cost as possible. This is what managing Alaska's resources for the benefit of all Alaskans really looks like. Resident hunters continue to have low-cost, world-class hunting opportunities, and small guide businesses continue to support their families and local communities. And with that, I'll hand it over to Thor.
Stand by. Any questions?
Maybe at this point.
Senator Cargo.
Thank you. I almost started feeling sorry for you when you went down your list. I know the feeling. How many residents do you guide? What's the breakdown of non-resident residents, just out of curiosity?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, good question. Are you asking for my business specifically or more as an industry on the whole?
I was thinking more as an industry, but maybe yours is typical. So give me a concept.
Okay. This is taken, so as an industry as a whole, this is coming from our 2015 economic report. You'll find on the last page approximately 154 Alaskan residents were guided by hunting guides in the state in 2015. So personally for my business, I get contacted probably half a dozen times a year by residents asking for trips. We try to accommodate them if we can. Generally, it tends to be guys who want to come deer hunting or something to that effect. So probably end up taking one to two resident hunters per year.
So just a smaller portion of yours.
Yeah, certainly a smaller portion.
Thank you. All right, proceed.
For the record, my name is Thor Stacey. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Alaska Professional Hunters Association. My goal of this presentation is to provide a little bit of the background on some of the policy, legal, and regulatory framework that this bill would affect. On a personal level, I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I've utilized wildlife as a resident hunter, a hunting guide, federally qualified subsistence user, trapper. So I have a personal level of use and interest in this bill. I hold registered guide license number 1194. And I have a federal concession in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So I'm going to walk through the bullet points that I'm going to kind of walk through are a little bit of a background on the guide required law, our duty as hunting guides to the public, a brief discussion on the Board of Game, talk about what destabilizing regulatory regimes look like, and then talk a little bit just SB 87 in context of the future, looking forward and how we see this measure kind of interwoven into how we see the future and would like the future to look like. First, the requirement to hire a hunting guide for non-residents pre-existed statehood. That was a requirement in territorial days. And for committee members, we have an outline here. And I have a little bit more detailed outline here for my talking points, which I'm happy to provide the committee afterwards. So the requirement for non-residents to hire a guide is an old requirement. After statehood, the legislature required that non-residents hire a guide for doll sheep and brown and grizzly bear. Later on, mountain goats were added to the list for the guide required species. The reason for the requirement for non-residents to retain a hunting guide our safety in dangerous terrain and dangerous climate. Alaska is vast with different terrain, very few roads, resources, fast-flowing rivers, et cetera. And then for safety related to dangerous animals, mainly the handling of brown grizzly bears. With that requirement came an industry, and that industry is hunting guides. And so as such, what Mr. Rohr brought up here about the chain of benefits and his livelihood, that's not a guarantee. That's a privilege that we recognize that we have. The resource is commonly owned by all Alaskans. We do not in any way, shape, or form feel a sense of ownership for the resource. This is reserved for common use and equal access. So what's our duty to the public? Our duty to the public is to support and promote our core competencies as professionals, safety, safety, safety. We, as professionals, animals are highly valued by Alaskans, hunters and non-hunters alike. We must demonstrate a respect for the animals, land, and water, and act as stewards of the land and these wildlife resources when using them for commercial purposes. We have to, as a group, this is something that guides struggle with, but it's something that as a group and an industry that we have to work within the constitutional framework laid out for us. It would be nice if the guides could lay claim in a private property sense to wildlife resources just from a pure profitability perspective. But as an industry, we have to recognize that we have to operate within the broad constitutional framework, whether we like it or not. We don't have a limited entries amendment in the Constitution, for instance. And then most importantly, it's treat other users with respect. As a commercial use for a valued animal, for valuable animals, for food, for enjoyment, for, in our case, for livelihoods, it's important that we demonstrate respect for other users. So those are some of the duties that we have to the general public. I'll talk a little bit about the Board of Game. You know, there was a Mr. Rohr made a reference to the allocation, the 13% allocation for non-residents. As hunting guides, we are a much smaller portion of that total allocation. Of approximately 100,000 hunters that buy licenses every year in Alaska, we guide a little over 3,000 hunters, some of which are resident hunters. As according to the most recent reports. So we occupy 3% of the hunter effort. As far as the Board of Game, we support the board's efforts to create regulatory and allocation schemes for the maximum benefit of all Alaskans, non-hunters and hunters alike. Many of the benefits we bring are to non-hunters and business owners, such as what Sam mentioned in his testimony. Sustained yield is number one. The resource must be sustainably managed. We support the statutory mandates for resident preference, as referenced by the bill sponsor, Senator Coghill, early on, for food, animals, and animals recognized for a subsistence priority. We support those existing preferences. Most importantly, subsistence is important. We support subsistence preferences and work with rural residents all around the state to make sure folks are meeting their needs. If we have extra meat available, we share that resource with Alaskans all over the state. Now, I'll move to destabilatory regulatory regimes. What's the worst case scenario for our businesses and our viability? The worst case scenario is that we lose a sustainable resource, that for some reason the animal populations can no longer endure harvests and that the health of the wildlife itself is in jeopardy. That's the absolute worst case scenario. Now, purely from a management perspective, the worst case scenario from us is a drawing hunt or a permit hunt where we do not have a concession program in place. We have opposed many efforts to put allocation proposals in front of the Board of the Game where the resource is healthy and can endure harvest, but that the proponents are asking for permits to simply reallocate the resource even though that the population can endure that harvest, where there's not a concession program in place. If we don't have concessions, we can simply not live in a random draw world without some kind of concession underneath our feet. Finally, the effect of that situation most affects state land guides. Both the guides that you have at the table here do not operate or work on state land. However, we care about what happens to guides on state land as much as we care about what happens to guides with concessions on federal lands. Now, worst case scenario for hunters. First off, this is hunters broadly, non-guides, just how we see the world. Loss of a sustainable resource. A high cost to participate. If you raise costs to hunt, you're going to lose participation and you're going to lose the future hunters on the landscape. Or preclude existing hunters from being able to participate. And by that I mean licenses, tags, just the burden from the state. A complex regulatory packet. I think earlier in this hearing there was an excellent example of what's called the handy-dandy. Complex regulatory schemes confuse and discourage hunter participation. All hunts on drawing. Drawing hunts require a random chance to participate. Drawing hunts discourage hunter participation, especially young hunters hoping to get into the hunting world now. Preference point systems. Preference points benefit older hunters, hunters that have time to have a lot of applications. They're discriminatory against younger hunters. They don't give the same opportunity. So, and then land, of course, we can't forget land use and land access. If you can't access the land, you can't access the resource. If you put undue burdens on new hunters, you're going to lose hunter participation. So, finally, we look at SB 87 and how it works into this nexus of the current situation in the future. I would refer the committee to this national rates of hunter participation in the western states, examples as well. Nationally, since 1991, we went from 14 million hunters to 11.4 million hunters. As a percentage of the population, we went from 7% in 1991 of the U.S. population to 4%. In the western states example, we went from, in 1991, 1.1 million hunters to 697,000 hunters. We went from a percentage of the population hunting of 4% to 2%. So objectively, when you look at the policies around the country, especially in the western states, the examples that proponents of this bill are using to suggest that we should comply with, there has not been a success for hunter participation. It has not been a success for overall numbers of hunters in the field. Nothing has changed as far as the gross acreages. I'm sure these other states have sustainably managed populations, but we're losing hunters at a high rate. Objectively, objectively, the policies that the proponents are suggesting should be put in place in Alaska have been a failure. We would suggest that the other states would do better to follow Alaska's example. Sustained yield, maximum benefit, allocation authority kicked to a regulatory board to work specifically with groups and others. We would suggest that Alaska's model is actually a better model and requires less impediments to the hunter. And finally, I would just say that a permit, however you call it, you're mandating another layer of bureaucracy. You're mandating, through changing the word from may to shall, you are mandating an additional burden of proof on the Board of Game process, and you're mandating an additional extra number of pages in the handy-dandy. You're mandating things that we can demonstrate, discourage hunter participation, and will likely cost conservation dollars to the Division of Wildlife. And with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate, and the committee appreciate the time. Hope to find some flesh out just the overall kind of framework as we see it.
Thank you for your testimony this afternoon, Mr. Stacy. If there's any questions from the committee, question I have is: can you think of any other instances in state statute where we have similar sideboards or sideboards on the Board of Game as far as limiting non-resident access to game?
Chair Birch, there's multiple layers of resident preference built into the statutes now. First off, you have the amounts necessary for subsistence hurdle. So first and foremost, the way we read the statutes and the way we respond to the Board of Game process, the animals described, food animals or traditional subsistence animals, those animals are first and foremost for Alaskans. And if there's a restriction, you go to things like Tier 1, Tier 2 subsistence hunts where there's no resident participation. I would point out that in the caribou example that was given earlier, it's a false example. There's multiple caribou herds that interact with the Dalton Highway corridor. The Teshikpuk caribou herd, the Central Arctic caribou herd, the Western Arctic caribou herd, and there's a potential for a porcupine caribou to join the Central Arctic herd. So the example given there wouldn't necessarily meet, even in the statutory burden, it's not as clear cut as the proponents would make. So we see a subsistence priority, and we see priorities all throughout the hunting regulations for residents, both in regulation and statute.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? Senator Kawasaki?
Yep, thank you. Just a brief question. The testimony earlier from the resident hunters of Alaska, and I don't know if these statistics are correct or not, but I just wanted to get maybe a reason why these numbers are so high. They mentioned the number of non-resident sheep hunting opportunities in interior, and that 60 to 80% go to non-residents. That the board also allocates 40% to Kodiak brown bear to non-residents, and that moose draw permits where non-residents are allowed to hunt, at least 50% of the allocation goes to non-residents. Can you tell me why those numbers are so high? They just seem high.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, that's a great question. I was hoping for the question. I'll start with the sheep example. The sheep example, there's multiple units where there's very high rates of non-resident take. Now that's the actual harvest, okay? So the participation or the opportunity, the numbers of people that say starting at the beginning of the race, it'll be between 15% and 30% of the hunter participation is non-resident, but that results in up to 80% of the actual take or the harvest. Those areas are all state land areas. So those are the same areas that we have gone to the Board of Game, our group, asked the Board of Game to support guide concessions, asked the Board of Game to defer drawing hunts, while at the same time we came to the legislature asking to restrict the number of guides on state land. We've opposed, and keep in mind that there's no conservation concern stated by the department. There's no the population is still sustainably managed, but we recognize that those numbers are a little out of whack and that we have asked to limit the number of hunting guides in those areas, and we've asked to do so through a concession program. Kodiak Island is an interesting example. Kodiak Island has both areas that are wide open to hunting opportunity and those that are put on a strict drawing system. The hunting guides have become kind of, I think in the committee discussions we've heard Senator Reinbold express frustration about Anchorage area bear management and risks to the populations. Kodiak is an example where you have the largest land carnivore in the world, and nobody is having trash problems or getting mauled inside the communities. So as that bear plan evolved, those rates of non-resident harvest and guided take evolved to achieve those management objectives, which are fairly complex, but the end result is about, I think it's a total 100 non-resident participation rate of around 37%. Mm-hmm. So it's a nuanced, and a bear is not a food animal. On the moose hunting example, is a very specific example in a very remote part of the state. And I cannot recall all of the deliberations or all of the decisions made on that hunt off the top of my head, but I believe that it has to do with the remote nature and the high expense to access that area, and the fact that when the numbers of resident tags were higher, there was more tags being drawn but not being utilized. So they weren't achieving the total harvest objective. So by raising the non-resident numbers, they were like, hey, we're taking the number of moose that we need to in this remote, expensive, and difficult to access portion of the state. So if that answers the senator's question.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if this is a question better for APHA testifiers or for the sponsor, but I guess I could use some clarification on which animals we're really talking about here. We've heard a group of folks talk about moose and caribou and deer, and we've heard some discussion about brown bear, grizzly bear, doll sheep, and I'm the guy who goes through the handy dandy and figures out where I'm likely to try and chase critters this year, and I'm having trouble with the interaction of the statute being changed in 87. I don't think we're just talking about tier 1, tier 2 hunts, but I'm not sure if we're talking about every four-legged critter. Can I get some help with that?
Chair Cargo?
Anything that falls under the definition big game. So that is a little different than food animals, as was said. So it would be the sheep, the bear, outside of what I talked about, the preference for uses in Alaska. So that'd be the way I understand it.
Thank you. Yep, thank you. Seeing no further questions, thank you very much for your testimony this afternoon, Mr. Rohrer and Mr. Stacy. Very much appreciate that. Last but not least, we have Rod Arno from the Alaska Outdoor Council. Mr. Arno, please join us at the table. Introduce yourself for the record, and you're welcome to proceed with your remarks. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Birch, Chairman, and committee members. My name is Rod Arno. I live in Palmer, Alaska. I'm an ex-outdoorsman that I'm employed by the Alaska Outdoor Council. That we've got about 10,000 Alaskan residents. We have about 4,500 individual, and then we represent 46 clubs. So the Outdoor Council, well, like TSI right here in town, and SCI, and APHA. So Alaskan residents, through banquets, get together $50,000 every year, and they pay me to come to meetings and to go to the Board of Game, the Board of Fisheries, the Federal Land Management meetings, and the Federal Subsistence Board. So the Outdoor Council did have its annual meeting up in Fairbanks this weekend. We had 30 delegates from the 47 clubs, and they voted to on 87 to ask you not to pass it out of committee. And the reason for that is that it's unnecessary. And Senator Coghill explained that when he quoted from 1605-255D. That regulations adopted in this section must provide that consistent with the subsistence provisions in 1605-258, the taking moose, deer, elk, caribou by residents for personal or family consumption as a preference for taking by non-residents. So that takes care, we feel, of the allocation between residents and non-residents. There was a court case, 1955, Shepherd versus the state of Alaska, and in that court case, it showed clearly that the state of Alaska does have that authority to give a preference to residents, and they clearly did that in the subsistence priority in 1605-258, where we have a tier system, and only an Alaskan resident can participate in those subsistence hunts. So when it comes down to food shortage, food supply, that all residents have that opportunity over non-residents. And in the Shepherd versus USA, or actually the state of Alaska and the department, it's clear from the Supreme Court that they considered non-residents as trophy hunters. So there's a little more of the history on that. Going back to why, when federal management came into the state and they were deciding what was customary and traditional for species, they left out all of the state's determinations for sheep and for bear because they weren't considered subsistence animals because of the bears. Very few people that I've run into in my 45 years eat brown bear, and for sheep because it was harder to get to. And they were the primary animals for the guide industry, and that was the reason why they were left out of 1605-255D. Alaska's Constitution, under general authority, Article 8, Section 2, the legislature shall provide for the utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources belonging to the state, including land, waters, for the maximum benefit of its people, not just hunters, but of its people. Reserving a portion of high-quality game for non-residents to help pay for management benefits all Alaskans. And since I've been paying attention to the board process in the early 80s. that number of non-residents hasn't fluctuated much. It's been between 10,000 and 15,000. So there hasn't been this constant increase in the number of non-residents. And as was pointed out by the representative for APHA, a lot of those non-residents are family and friends of residents that do participate in hunting. The legislature is considering several proposals to cut state government right now. You are being asked to make very difficult decisions. Do you really want to add game management to that list, keeping in mind that the non-resident proportion is about 70%, and in the past I've seen it up to about 86% of all of the Division of Wildlife Conservation is paid through the Fish and Game Fund and the matching PR funds. Non-resident hunters also have a stake in Alaska's wildlife management, so we need to keep them on board. Participating in the last ballot box biology over the black bear baiting that the Outdoor Council received a fair amount of money from outside hunting organizations to help us defeat that ballot measure. And I ask each committee member, if I was to ask each committee member to define reasonably satisfied, I'm confident that I'd get about seven different answers. I don't believe hunters have been reasonably satisfied since they left the Fertile Crescent, and some turn left and some turn right, and we met here. Should that non-resident opportunity be reduced, I would be fearful of believing that residents would pick up the slack in that funding. Having recently gone through the process where we increased the guide license a few years ago, AOC, of course, was one that advocated for that license increase. You know, we told member clubs it was in order to keep the federal match. Hunters were hesitant, but during the deliberations in the committees when we were trying to get the legislatures to pass the bill increase, numerous legislatures asked us, they said, are you sure that your resident hunters are agreeable to this increase? Well, so that'd be a hard one to replace. As far as the board process, boy, it's not the best that there is, or it is the best it is. In fact, it's the only one that there is that has a public process. At the close of every meeting of the Board of Game, there's a discussion and they pick a date for the next upcoming meeting. Well in advance, the department announces a call for proposals of game management units, so every individual can put in any proposal they want before that board. The public has the opportunity to write, submit proposals, and sometimes they're done by individuals, often by ACs. Proposals are published. They're available for written comment. Those written comments go into the packet. The public has the opportunity to offer written comments. And then when the board meet on that region for those proposals, then everyone has another chance to submit more written comments and give oral testimony. You know, it's clear that it's not perfect, but the legislature has created a functional, accessible, transparent system. It did so because your predecessors here quickly saw that they did not want to be in the business of allocating game. I spent a lot of time connecting with hunters. I do it at the advisory committee process. I do it at the boards. I do it at the sports shows. And I can honestly say that the majority of Alaskans would prefer to go battle it out as they do before the boards on allocation much more than they would have you folks take that under your wing. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much for your testimony this afternoon, Mr. Arno. See if there's any questions from the committee. Senator Giesel.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one of the things that I pondered was the comment that there were zero fiscal notes.
Yeah.
So I took a look at the fiscal note for Department of Fish and Game, Wildlife Conservation. Let's see, I can't tell you what the number is right offhand. But in any case, on page 2 under the analysis, what Mr. Arno just referenced was the PR fund, the Fish and Game Fund, which leverages PR money for the state, projecting a potential loss of $22.6 million. And then, of course, the license and tags, potential loss, $7.5 million. And that's ADF&G Conservation. Hold on, let me find the title on that one. Wildlife Conservation Appropriation. Then under Statewide Support Services, they don't quantify any loss of revenue, but it looks like they'd probably have to be making some changes in how they schedule meetings and things like that. So in any case, it's not exactly zero fiscal notes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. That's a very good point. It had been my intention at the conclusion of our invited testimony to ask Director Grasser if maybe he could comment on the fishing game fiscal note, because, yeah, it's made for a little clarification. Any other questions for Rod? Thanks, Rod. Appreciate you being here this afternoon. That does conclude our invited testimony, and with that, Mr. Grasser, if you're online, I thought maybe you could give us a follow-up on the fiscal note question that's come up earlier.
Mr. Chairman, this is Eddie Grasser, Director of Wildlife Conservation for the Department of Fish and Game. I'd be happy to do so.
Okay, yeah, proceed.
The fiscal note that we submitted was a zero fiscal note with some information about possible costs, but since we really have no idea what the impact of the bill would be, and we couldn't, we spent a lot of time, including with our attorneys, trying to figure out what that was, we opted for a zero fiscal note because we had no information as to what the impact would be without actually putting this into practice.
Okay. Any questions from committee members? Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, one that I can't imagine the director has on hand, I'd be happy to get it later on if that works, is a breakdown of the non-resident fees by species so that we can sort of get a look at, you know, is this disproportionately on the brown and grizzly bears and doll sheep, or is it spread evenly through the deer and caribou?
Fair enough. Mr. Grasser, if you could provide that to me, we'll make sure we get that information out to committee members.
Mr. Chairman, we can provide that.
Oh, great. Other questions? Okay. I think that thank you very much for the follow-up. Hearing no additional questions, at this time we'll go ahead and set the bill aside. I would like to thank...
Just make a comment before we set it aside. First of all, I wanted to thank all who testified today. And so what I intend to do is take all this information in, and once again, if I think there's something that can be brought forward to either correct or over argue a point, I would be glad to do that. I just wanted to thank you for letting these folks have a chance to have their say. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Senator, as well. It was very instructive. Appreciate your efforts here and the efforts and participation of our invited testifiers this afternoon. At this point, our next Resources Committee meeting will be on Friday, April 5th, when we will take up two bills, Senate Bill 91 on the Noyakuk River Hydroelectric Site and Senate Bill 95 on the Alaska Railroad Corporation land transfers. With that, this meeting is adjourned at 4:40 p.m.